Welcome back to the program. It was often said that Dick Cheney redefined the role of the modern vice president by creating what many felt was his own executive branch inside the Bush White House. In so doing, he wielded power, influence, and often usurped the very president he served. Today, Joe Biden inherits that office and himself has extraordinary power and influence. But he achieves it in a wholly different way, by partnering rather than competing with the president he serves. This is the subject of the cover story yesterday in the magazine section of the New York Times, written by a guest that has been with us before, and it is a pleasure to have James Traub, contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine, back on this program to talk about his cover story after Cheney. James Traub, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Jeff.
Good to have you here. Talk about how the relationship between Obama and Biden has evolved over the past year, and what he thought of Biden at the beginning, and how that's changed as the relationship has evolved.
Yeah, well, Jeff, as I point out in the piece, these guys were not pals before. When Obama first came to the Senate in 2005, he looked around for some mentors and found them. Biden was not one of them. And I think, if anything, Biden felt a little bristly when this kid got on the Foreign Relations Committee, of which he was chairman, and here he was, this kind of young superstar with no particular experience, and Biden sees himself as the sort of ancient of days who has been there and met everyone and knows everything. There was some resentment, and not all that much warmth. And when Obama chose Biden as his running mate in 2008, it wasn't because he was building on this very close relationship. I think he thought Biden was a good match for him in a bunch of ways, and Biden, who had some reluctance because he didn't want to give up being chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and obviously he had hoped to be president, agreed. I think, though, I suspect during the campaign, and then in the months after the campaign, I think Obama came to feel that Biden was someone whose judgment he could trust. And if you look at this astonishing internal debate over the last 2 months in the White House over Afghanistan, an awful lot of it seems to be about Obama turning to people who know more than he does about the specific situation on the ground in Afghanistan and trying to figure out whose judgment is right. Now, when we hear the speech he's going to give tomorrow, it's not going to sound like the Biden plan. A lot of it's going to sound like not the Biden plan. But clearly Biden has influenced that debate in important ways, and he's influenced other debates, and I think he'll do so very much in the future.
One of the things you talk about with regard to Biden is that he brings to it a level of political skill, sort of an old-fashioned politician, that he brings to both his dealings in the White House and also his dealings in Iraq.
Well, you know, it's fun to listen to Biden when he's not talking for quotation and just talking, because, as I say in the piece, he sounds like, you know, an old baseball manager talking about the opposing lineup. You know, he knows all their tendencies, he knows their weaknesses, he knows what pitches they like to hit. So he talks that way about whether it's Hu Jintao or Bibi Netanyahu or whatever. And that is his natural way of approaching these big foreign policy issues. I mean, it's not that he's not a thoughtful guy. He's, you know, devours policy books and is very much a kind of Washington type in that regard. But he's also someone who thinks about the world the way politicians think about the world, in terms of people and what they do and how they're going to react. And that is part of his benefit, I think, that he brings to Obama. Obama is a much more abstract person, much more than most politicians are, more of an intellectual, more remote. Obama is more of a, pardon me, Biden is more of a fingertip person.
One of the things you say near the end of the article about Biden is that he knows many little things but no big things, really the idea being that he doesn't bring all of this knowledge to any kind of grand narrative sense.
Well, you know what? Neither do most people in that line of work. You know, if you were to ask me, okay, what's Hillary's worldview? I don't know what her worldview is. I would say Biden probably has more of a worldview than Hillary, but certainly less of one than Obama, who, as I say, is more of a thinker in that regard. So what Biden has is a tremendous amount of knowledge on the ground. One thing that people told me that I was very struck by is that your average senator, when he goes on one of these visits you read about in the paper, he's there for a day or a night, and, you know, and then he's gone, and he has the photo op with the troops, and he meets with the head of state and so on, and that's it, and followed by a big gaggle of reporters. Biden does not do that, or at least he didn't before he was vice president, when he had the leisure to make these choices. he would go to a place, whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan or Georgia, he'd go for 4, 5, 6 days. And he would travel just with one other senator, sometimes Richard Lugar, sometimes Chuck Hagel, various people. And he would, as much as possible, would go with no publicity whatsoever. And so he could really drill down and talk to people. And so other of his colleagues in the Senate will say that he has a level of specificity in his knowledge about people and places which nobody else in the Senate has.
Talk about this issue of Biden's judgment. You quote Tom Ricks in the piece saying, you know, what has Biden been right on? Talk a little about that.
Yeah, so Tom Ricks, who used to write for the Washington Post and wrote a great book on Iraq and is really an estimable guy, made the waspish comment in his blog that this guy's been wrong about everything when it comes to Iraq. He was opposed to the first Gulf War in 1990. He favored the Bush War. He opposed the surge. So why should we take his judgment seriously? Now, without dissecting each one of those votes, which I probably would agree were wrong in each case as well, I do think the guy, because he's not an abstract thinker, and you know, when you hear him talk about neocons, for example, his objection to them is that they're abstract a priori thinkers. They don't look at the evidence before him. I think one reason why I suspect that Obama trusts Biden's judgment, at least insofar as he does, is this is a guy who's driven by the facts, and he's not afraid of changing his mind. Now, in politics, changing your mind can be a fairly lethal thing to do. But if you look at the way Biden has come to view Afghanistan, or previously in the case of Iraq, I think he saw that his original optimism in both cases was misplaced. And it's very interesting to think, for example, about how his views of something like nation building, which we hear about a lot and talk about a lot, have changed. That's been a big article of faith for a lot of liberals. You know, let's not talk about regime change and the use of violence. Let's talk about the slow, persistent work of nation building. That's good. And that tends to go along with the military doctrine of counterinsurgency. Well, it all sounds good, but you can see Biden beginning to reflect on that and saying, well, you know what? It certainly didn't work in Iraq. Maybe that's because we didn't do it right. And then he comes to Afghanistan, where he's basically come to the conclusion we can't even do it right. We're not going to succeed with building institutions in a country where most people are illiterate. There are very few rudiments of a state. There are very few solid institutions. We may want to do it, but we can't do it. And I think Biden is someone who can distinguish in his mind between what would be good for us and what, in fact, we can do.
And one of the things you talk about is that his approach is a pragmatic one, not one that comes from an excessive moralism, necessarily.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting question, you know, because for liberal Democrats, you know, the big issue is, are we going to use our power to bring justice in the world? Are we going to be willing to act, for example, in the face of atrocities in Darfur and elsewhere, in the Balkans, for example? And Biden has generally ranged himself on that side. He's kind of in the 90s, became a kind of interventionist guy. He was in favor of acting in Bosnia. He was in favor of acting in the Balkans. He was in favor of acting in Darfur. And so in that sense, you'd say, well, kind of left wing of the Democratic Party, or at least that kind of muscular liberal interventionism. But when he talks about it, he's very careful to use as much non-moral and strategic as moral language. He'll say, look, we had to act in Kosovo because it was a NATO commitment, and if we hadn't acted, it would have been a disaster for NATO. Or he'll say, we had to do something in Bosnia because if the kind of ethnic sectarian nationalism that was then so inflamed moved westwards into Central Europe, that would be bad for security. So he tends to reach some of these liberal conclusions, but through a much more hard-headed form of reasoning.
One of the things you say is that he and Obama often reach a similar conclusion, but through a very different process.
Yeah, well, because, again, Obama is a cerebral person. And Biden, though, as I say, you know, no dummy at all, is more informed by direct experience. But the specific thing I was talking about there is a certain kind of chastened quality they both have. That is, when you talk to Obama, as I have done, he will tell you that he admired the so-called realists of the 50s and 60s, who were very, the folks like George Kennan, who were the architects of the Cold War, very aware of the limitations of America's power. Biden, interestingly, is also a big fan of George Kennan. In fact, he had Kennan come give him advice when he was a very young senator. Biden also, despite his kind of optimistic personality, over the years has come to see that a great American idealistic plans don't pan out. So both of them wind up on the kind of chastened side when it comes to grandiose plans. And I think when we hear Obama tomorrow, we will hear someone who is very careful not to make the kinds of large sweeping promises which Bush so often made in terms of bringing democracy to the Middle East, for example, that he later came to regret, or at least that some people around him came to regret.
Talk a little bit about Iraq and Obama turning to Biden and basically saying, you handle Iraq.
Yeah, well, you know, Iraq became kind of the forgotten issue. You know, as the administration realized that Afghanistan was an utter mess and a real kind of clear and present danger, and when I say Afghanistan, I include Pakistan, the focus shifted from Iraq to Afghanistan. Iraq, we had a timetable. We were going to withdraw. Our combat troops would withdraw by the middle of next year, and all of our troops would be gone by 2011, so it was as if we had it on rails. But it became clear that it was falling off the rails, that, you know, Iraq is in no sense whatsoever a settled issue. And the kind of sectarian hatred which has burned so brightly there is still very much in evidence, and it's still a tremendously violent and insecure place. So it was clear that the administration had to have someone at a high level focusing on Iraq. So rather than appoint a special envoy, as he's done with other places, in effect, Biden became a kind of part-time special envoy and shuttle diplomat to Iraq. And Biden originally said to him, I want you to go every month. And Biden said, look, that's too often. I'll go every other month. And so that has become his portfolio, and it's a much less controversial one than Afghanistan. There's not a whole lot of difference of opinion inside the administration or even between Democrats and Republicans about what we have to do there. So it's easier at that level, but it's really hard at the level of getting the Iraqis to do what it is we believe they have to do.
Talk a little about Biden's role inside the White House. You talk about his role as a kind of peacemaker among various staff members in the international policy arena.
My impression is that Obama himself was initially quite concerned about this whole team of rivals thing. Not, I don't know whether it had to do with different beliefs. Much more, these are big people. Hillary, Bill Gates, Robert Gates at Defense, Leon Panetta, CIA, and so on. James Jones, National Security Advisor. He was worried there would just be a lot of turf wars and personality clashes. And Biden was the only one there who'd known them all for years. Obama tasked Biden to, in effect, ride herd on that. Now, Biden said to me, and there's really not much evidence to the contrary, that that hasn't been an issue like it was in the case of the Bush administration. There haven't been these issues, except between Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, and John Brennan, the director of Central Intelligence. There was a real fight. And in fact, that was one where Biden did step in and adjudicate it. I don't know to what effect, though one hasn't heard about the tension, you know, as we did back in April or May or so. That is part of his role. And I think, you know, it shows the degree to which Obama trusts Biden, and the advantage that Biden brings with his knowledge of so many of these players over so long a period of time.
Of course, the real test internally is when something happens that brings either great success or great failure, and people are either taking credit or passing blame.
Yeah, well, so right now, kind of everything is up in the air. Obama's going to make this announcement tomorrow, but it's going to be a long time before we can make a judgment about whether this thing has worked or not. In the case of Iraq, it may be sooner, because Biden's great achievement there was helping persuade the parties to agree on an electoral law which will allow a national election scheduled for January to take place. But it suddenly unraveled. And so everything one fears about Iraq, which is this kind of zero-sum sectarian reasoning, has begun to rear its head. And so after a very heady moment when all these parties quite miraculously reached a tough agreement on, I won't go into the details, but on this electoral law, a leading Sunni figure said, no, it's going to be banned for the Sunnis. I'm not going to sign it. And he's one of the vice presidents, so he had the power to veto the law. So suddenly there's the real danger the whole thing could go south. There wouldn't be an election. And so, yeah, Biden, who no one, in a way, no one's paid attention to the Iraq portfolio because it's just, as long as there's no problems, nobody really notices. But Biden still has quietly gotten credit for it. Well, it's not going to look so good if the election doesn't happen because the electoral law hasn't, in fact, been agreed on.
What role has Biden played in domestic policy?
Well, you know, I followed that much less, so I'm less comfortable talking about it. What I can say is that, for example, on the big one, health care reform, one of Biden's jobs on legislation generally, foreign, domestic, whatever, is to be in constant contact with his former colleagues in the Senate. And so he is calling wavering senators, I suspect, very often. That is, the sort of the immediate step below having the president talk to them is going to be having Biden talk to them. And so that's a big part of his job. In general, I think schmoozing with these folks, he hangs around in the Senate gym. He talks to them all the time. Biden, you know, talks to everybody all the time. So that's a part of his portfolio. No, and I'd say one other thing that's an important part of his portfolio is he has been something of a spokesman for the economic package, for the $787 spending package. And this sort of the hope has been that this guy has a lot more credibility with working class Democrats and generally independents than Obama, who's a more cool to the touch kind of figure.
One of the things that you talk about with respect to Biden is that he thought early on that he was the most qualified to be president. How has he reconciled the end of that dream?
I don't know that he has. He's never said, I will not be a candidate for president. Now, the fact is, he's not going to run against Obama in 2012, so if he had any chance to be president, it would be in 2016. At that point, he'll be 73, 74. Well, that is just too old. I mean, you know, McCain was 70, and he was viewed as too old. Now, it is true that Biden is a tremendously healthy guy, but it is also true that Biden is someone who deeply believes that he would be a terrific president. And he says all the right things about Obama, whom he clearly genuinely respects. But that doesn't mean he doesn't still think that he would be a terrific president and America needs him. That's the way guys like that think. So I don't actually think he's ever going to run. But I do think in his head he thinks it would be good for America if he did. And so perhaps that's why he can't quite bring himself to say, no, I'm not running.
James Traub, his article After Cheney appears yesterday as the cover story in the magazine section of the New York Times. James, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for being with us.
All right. Thank you, James.